Headlines: French President Emmanuel Macron calls a national security meeting to discuss the Israeli-made Pegasus spyware after reports about its use in France. Iran's president announces the opening of the country's first oil export terminal outside the strategic Strait of Hormuz in the Gulf of Oman. And a Palestinian man dies in an Israeli prison several days after his arrest. Media reports say he succumbed to torture inside the prison. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is the World News. Our top story for this half-hour: French President Emmanuel Macron has called for an unscheduled national security meeting to discuss the use of Israeli-made Pegasus spyware in his country. A French government spokesman said Macron has taken the issue very seriously and is dedicating the meeting to the question of cybersecurity. The meeting comes amid recent reports showing the usage of Pegasus spy software for spying on international figures, including activists, journalists, and politicians. Macron himself has been enlisted as a potential target of the spyware created by an Israeli firm, NSO. It has been strongly criticized for the software's misuse for espionage activities in many countries, including the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Bahrain. Syrian air defenses have intercepted several Israeli missiles over the western province of Homs. A military source says the attack has only caused material damage. Our Damascus correspondent joined us earlier with more on the incident. Let's take a listen.
Syrian state media confirmed that there has been an Israeli aggression on Syria, particularly on the city of on the governorate of Homs. The Syrian state TV also confirmed that the attack exactly targeted the area of Al-Qasir. Al-Qasir is a border town with Lebanon. It's just 8 kilometers away from northern Lebanon over there. No further details were given by any official source yet. However, usually a statement comes out from an official military source giving some detail. What we know for sure is that air defenses were activated directly with the aim of intercepting the enemy missiles. Now, this Israeli attack comes only 24 hours after a similar one in which Israel attacked yesterday the area of Al-Sfira, south of Aleppo, targeting Syrian army positions over there.
Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has announced the opening of a new oil export terminal in the Gulf of Oman that will allow the shipments to avoid the strategic Strait of Hormuz. Speaking during a cabinet meeting, Rouhani said the 1,000-kilometer pipeline is now operational at the port city of Jask. Rouhani noted that the pipeline was built in a matter of 2 years. He said the project is the Islamic Republic's most strategic one that has been accomplished during the current administration. The president added Iran's oil has been exported through the Gulf of Oman, and that's what makes his project very significant. Rouhani said the inauguration of this project is a firm response to plotters, particularly the United States. A Palestinian prisoner has died in an Israeli jail, with media reports suggesting the man succumbed to torture inside the prison. Abdul Yusuf Al-Khatib Al-Tamimi was found dead in a cell in a prison in the city of Al-Quds. Palestinian media say Israeli prison staff severely beat him and used electric shock against him. But Israeli authorities say Al-Tamimi died of heart attack, a claim the victim's family has rejected, saying he's had no pre-existing medical conditions. Al-Tamimi was arrested for driving offenses and leaves behind a wife and 4 children. He is the latest victim among thousands of Palestinians languishing in Israeli prisons, many of them without charge. Palestinian prisoners are kept under deplorable conditions without proper hygienic standards. Many of them are subjected to systemic torture, harassment, and repression. Political analyst Saad Nimr says the international community must take action against Israel to make the regime stop violence against Palestinian prisoners.
The Israeli conduct generally against the Palestinian prisoners, in general, it's always to dehumanize the Palestinians. They never consider the Palestinian life matters at all. Now, concerning the Tamimi issue, apparently the brutality of the Israeli police, as the family had said, and based on witnesses who were there, They witnessed that he was beaten and he was assaulted against the law, and that what led to his death. What we need by the international community, not only a condemnation and statements of condemnation, but rather to start to take actions against the violation of the international law and the human rights laws. In this respect, we believe that international community should start putting pressure on Israel by economic means or by cutting or by really punishing the Israelis till they correct their records or till they stop these kind of atrocities against the Palestinians.
South Korea says the U.S. is awaiting Pyongyang's response to its offer for resuming denuclearization talks. Or more came from the office of South Korean President Moon Jae-in, that after a meeting between Moon and visiting U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman in Seoul. Sherman expressed hope that North Korea will soon respond to Washington's offer. She also said that she will discuss the issue with China during her visit there at the weekend as part of the East Asian tour. North Korea has so far given the cold shoulder to proposals from the administration of President Joe Biden for talks. It says the U.S. Talk of diplomacy is all words, no action, and aimed at covering up its own hostile acts. U.S. provocations against China continue relentlessly, and the latest, Washington has accused Beijing of hacking the Microsoft Exchange email system. The U.S. is making the accusation as it has ramped up its hacking and cyber allegations against Russia. The question is whether the U.S. is making such accusations with a political motive while making China appear like the bad guy on the world stage.
Tensions between the United States and China are rising once again. China has roundedly rejected the groundless and irresponsible hacking allegations made by the United States and its allies. Beijing says the allegations are fabricated out of nothing. The Chinese Foreign Ministry has hit back at Washington, calling the US the world champion of cyber attacks. Washington and several allies in Europe and Asia publicly accused Beijing of hacking the Microsoft Exchange server software in March.
Well, I would give the benefit of the doubt to China, given the fact that the United States is on a roll build up all kinds of accusations against China, really to create an enemy image and to increase pressure on China with regard to many different political and economic issues.
Microsoft Exchange is an email platform used by corporations around the world. Senior U.S. officials claimed that hackers tied to China's Ministry of State Security carried out the hacking. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said that Washington and its allies hold China accountable for what they have described as Beijing's pattern of irresponsible and destabilizing behavior in cyberspace. They claim China's alleged hacking poses a major threat to the U.S. economy and national security. The United Kingdom and European Union have also joined the U.S. in accusing China of carrying out hacking attacks. They claim the alleged cyber attacks have targeted an estimated hundreds of thousands of mostly small businesses and organizations. The U.S. Justice Department says four Chinese nationals have been charged in a global hacking campaign aimed at dozens of companies, universities, and government agencies in the United States and abroad.
The problem is that the underlying dynamic here is increasing tensions between the U.S. and China, not because of China's actions, but because of U.S. actions, which often provoke a reaction. A reaction may be increased cyber attacks, but that the basic problem is that the United States is regarding China as a rival, possibly as an enemy, and that's creating a lot of conflict.
Well, the accusation leveled against China by the U.S. is that Chinese hackers stole trade secrets and technology. It also alleges that China is sponsoring hackers outside of the government. Meanwhile, the U.S. itself stands accused of conducting the most hacking operations out of any country in the world. China says the CIA has hacked the country's aerospace, research facilities, oil industry, internet companies, and government agencies over an 11-year period.
China and the U.S. are already at loggerheads over several issues. Last year, Washington took a harsh stance against Chinese tech giant Huawei effectively banning the company from the U.S. Huawei is currently the world's largest telecoms equipment provider. Over the past few years, Washington stepped up arms sales to Taiwan, which is considered a red line by Beijing. Back in April, China warned the U.S. not to play with fire over Taiwan, as Washington moved to establish more diplomatic contact with officials in the self-ruled island. Tensions in the South China Sea risk turning into a full-blown confrontation between the two superpowers. The U.S. has already deployed 24 F-22 fighters to the Western Pacific as part of a military exercise in the Pacific Ocean. The deployment has been interpreted as a warning signal to China at a time when relations between Washington and Beijing have reached rock bottom over Taiwan and the disputed South China Sea. The exercise is in support of the 2018 National Defense Strategy, which called on the U.S. military to be a more lethal, adaptive, and resilient force to counter long-term strategic competition, primarily from China and Russia. The South China Sea has also emerged as a flashpoint. The United States frequently sends warships to challenge China's claims over the disputed waters under the pretext of safeguarding the freedom of navigation. China is also on course to overtake the U.S. and become the biggest economic powerhouse in the world within the next decade.
China has rejected a World Health Organization plan to audit Chinese labs as part of an investigation into COVID origins, calling it arrogant and disrespectful.
This plan takes the hypothesis of China's violation of laboratory procedures causing virus leakage as one of the research priorities. From this point, I can feel the disrespect for common sense and arrogance towards science revealed in this plan.
Zhang added that Beijing will not follow the proposal, saying it's opposed to politicizing the origins study. He said the Wuhan Institute of Virology has never designed, manufactured, nor leaked COVID-19. He said so far the staff and graduate students of the Wuhan Institute have maintained zero infection of COVID-19. On Friday, the WHO proposed a second phase of studies into the pandemic origins, calling on China to be, quote, transparent and open to cooperate. China had earlier called on the UN Health Agency to maintain its scientific and professional positions in tracing the matter. Political commentator Enner Tangen believes the World Health Organization has been under pressure from Washington in its investigation into the origins of COVID-19.
Well, obviously it's under pressure from Washington. I mean, that has not been hidden. There have been complaints about the leadership and the organization. There's been nitpicking at its budget, at its role, etc. It's a shame. The WHO was the only thing that was a clear bellwether in terms of what was necessary to be done, and now they're attacking that because they basically failed the test of dealing with it in their own countries. China feels that it was burnt when it cooperated with the WHO COVID investigation, and they feel that this is just, by many entities out there, a witch hunt that is more interested in painting China in a bad light than it is at getting at the truth. So rather than deal with the politics, China's asking that only scientific bodies recognize nonpartisan groups are involved in any kind of future investigations, and that these investigations not only target China, but look elsewhere.
Australian officials have warned that coronavirus cases could rise further as the country is struggling to contain a rapidly spreading Delta variant of the disease. The country's most populous state, New South Wales, reported 124 new infections, the highest in 16 months. Victoria State also logged 26 cases, a higher figure than a day before. The spike comes despite a weeks-long lockdown on over 13 million Australians, which has angered citizens. From the start of the pandemic, 915 Australians have succumbed to COVID-19. The overall caseload there is now hovering around 32,000. Authorities have been criticized for the slow vaccination process, with just 11% of the population being fully vaccinated so far. In China, more than 73,000 people have been evacuated from a flood-stricken city as torrential rains continue to lash the central province of Henan. Footage released by state media showed residents of Anyang City being evacuated by an excavator. At least 33 people have been killed In the province over the past couple of days, the victims include 12 passengers who were trapped in a submerged subway in the provincial capital, Zhengzhou. Several people remain missing. Authorities say the rainfall was the heaviest on record, with the rainstorm bringing almost a year's worth of precipitation in just 3 days. The deluge sparked the evacuation of over 200,000 people and disrupted transportation systems. The government has ordered an immediate review of subway flood controls and disaster relief measures. EU environment ministers say recent floods in Western Europe and extreme weather events around the globe must act as a wake-up call. Activists say the 27 country bloc's climate change goals are not ambitious enough. Jerome Hughes reports.
Operation continues in Belgium and Germany, the countries worst affected by last week's devastating floods following torrential rainfall. Senior figures from the European Commission have just attended a meeting of EU environment ministers.
50 degrees northwest Canada, 40 degrees in Siberia, 40 degrees in central Europe, the floods you've mentioned, the droughts agriculture is dealing with, wildfires.
Last week, the European Commission unveiled plans to cut greenhouse gas emissions in the 27-nation bloc by 55% over the next 9 years. The Commission claims it's a matter of life and death.
Environmentalists point to what's happening right now. Raging wildfires in parts of the United States and Canada, severe flooding in regions of China, crippling droughts in areas of Iran, recent tornadoes in the Czech Republic. In order to save the planet, campaigners insist the EU must cooperate with big powers like Russia, China and Iran instead of pushing them away.
Official data shows transport accounts for 29% of pollution in the EU, but one large ship generates as much carbon dioxide per day as 80,000 cars. Of course, the aviation industry is another major player, and so too is agriculture. Experts say the key is to cut our energy consumption and be more efficient. Environmental groups say the EU needs to move faster and claims the bloc's goals are simply not ambitious enough. They are demanding that leaders agree on decisive action when they meet at a major UN climate change conference scheduled for October in Glasgow, Scotland. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Saving Capitalism, directed by Jacob Cornbluth. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Clive Menzies, who is involved in Critical Thinking, a research and educational project which seeks to understand how the political economy works and identify levers for change. Now, Saving Capitalism is a documentary that explores the reasons why the economic system that once made the US strong is suddenly failing. The film is a clear-eyed examination of a political and economic status quo that no longer serves the people, exposing the powerful alliances between Washington and Wall Street, as well as the extreme wealth disparity in the US. And starring Robert Reich, and whose book inspired the film, served as Labor Secretary under President Bill Clinton, takes us through the US's fragile democracy and its fight for survival, and argues that it's up to ordinary US citizens to change the rules.
There's a huge amount of anger and frustration. So many people desperately wanting to be heard. And nobody is listening. It's up to us to change the rules. We are a two-tiered society composed of a few winners and a larger group of Americans left behind. And it's getting worse and worse and worse.
Thank you very much. Robert Reich, former Labor Secretary under President Clinton.
I want to go to places where I could actually interact. I really want to talk to people about their lives. Yes, that's true. As income and wealth go to the top, so does political power. People don't trust that our society is working for most people. Nobody in our society, the richest nation in the history of the world, should be working and not making it.
The old assumption has been the division is Democrat versus Republican.
Yeah, something's way off all over the country. Right, left, everybody. Something's wrong.
This is about power. It's about reclaiming our democracy and reclaiming our economy.
This country is upside down, and it's not working for 99% of our society anymore.
We are at a critical turning point in this country, and this is dangerous. The only way forward is to get organized and politically active.
New York now! New York now!
Democracy is a very fragile thing.
It's now up to the next generation.
First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. So I found this film an enlightening watch, and I think it offers an effective crash course on US inequality, particularly on the economy. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Saving Capitalism?
It's a really easy film to watch. It's made in a kind of gentle, smoothly edited, it carries you along, it's intriguing, it's gripping. And Robert Reich is a really great central character. He's kind of warm and a little bit scruffy and impish and funny.
Very entertaining to watch.
He's very entertaining, and the things he says are incredibly pointed and they grab your attention. The central topic of the film is really strong. I don't know, I mean, the title is a little bit, I think, misleading almost, because I think it will put off a lot of viewers. Mm-hmm. But the central idea of the fact that, the economic system in America is tilted so heavily toward corporations, is a really important message that I think needs to get out there. And so you're watching it, you feel your blood starting to boil. It's one of those documentaries that starts making you more and more angry, mm-hmm. even as it kind of gives you some ideas of the way forward or what's likely to happen.
And so. Clive, if I could turn to you. As a political economist, what's your take on Saving Capitalism?
My first reaction was that it was something of a political pitch. And it was very articulate, very well done. It articulated the symptoms extremely well. Whether Reich's prescription for the remedy is appropriate, I would question, because it's the pendulum swinging back and forth. And Reich emerged in the 60s and 70s, and he seems to hark back to that as some sort of golden era, but that was just a temporary blip post-war.
in this long war of attrition, which is effectively what they managed in the 60s and 70s, both in the UK and in the US, was some sort of social contract, which was a renegotiation of the terms of slavery. Mm-hmm. But slavery certainly wasn't abolished, and I'm not sure that the thrust of this film gets us any closer to abolishing slavery, which is effectively what this system is.
Well, I suppose this documentary could only cover so much ground in 90 minutes or so, but I'm just wondering, as someone who's not familiar with the economy, does this serve as a good introduction to get to grips with what capitalism is and the arguments that Reich makes?
Yeah, and I thought it was quite interesting. I was making notes as the film unfolded, and I was writing down names that I thought ought to have been mentioned, and sure enough, they come in. He mentions Robert Rubin as Treasury Secretary. And you look at the sort of Clinton administration dynamic, and to some extent, Reich was in there as the pigeon. And he fought very hard, and he said, my only regret was I didn't push harder. The irony is, he probably doesn't recognize that he couldn't have pushed harder, or he would have been out, or he wouldn't have got anywhere anyway. So I think it's, for all his 5 decades of experience, I'm not sure he's learnt the game sufficiently. He didn't realize the shark-infested pool in which he was operating.
No, we see his character sort of, and his character progression throughout the documentary, actually, and how sort of down-spirited he becomes, but also hopeful as well. But Rich, just wanted to ask you, for viewers not well versed with the economy, do you think this film serves as a good introduction then?
Well, it's very interesting. It's obviously from a particular point of view, but what it does explain in the way that I haven't heard explained quite so simply and straightforwardly is how the whole economy was founded on a principle that was flawed, mm-hmm. basically tilted toward the wealthy and corporations right from day one, mm-hmm. and how people with power just consolidate their power. So it's only gotten worse over the last 250 years. And it's just, now the general average person in America has no power really politically, which is quite a shocking thing to say. But when you think about it, it's true. And you look at the way laws are being passed and the way the government is behaving, mm-hmm. That's kind of how it's working. And but you see little, people taking bites out of it. So I think the system has room to correct itself, and that helps while you're watching the film. It helps you not be completely hopeless.
Yeah, strong arguments to be made in the film, and of course aided by great animation sequences, yeah. and graphics as well.
Yeah.
Intuition right now is clear. Something's wrong all over the country, right, left, everybody. Something's way off.
The old assumption has been the division is Democrat versus Republican.
Yeah. That's
but
crazy.
What we're beginning to see, yep. is that it's actually anti-establishment,
yeah.
versus establishment.
Yep.
It's people who don't want the big money and the crony capitalism versus the crony capitalists.
Yeah.
Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, liberals, there's going to be disagreement on a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But if you could come together on these, yeah. fundamentals.
It's fine with me. You're at a deeper level, right? You've been teaching economics and all that for 30 years. I used to use your book.
You, yeah. used to use my book.
I used to use it.
Can
what
we just make, can you...
And
can
I have a book out, too.
Can we get that again? Congressman, what do you think of the title?
Yeah, I know. It surprised me a little bit coming for you, but in a pleasant way. I think you and I are united on if we can do this in the right way, ethics and capitalism together, and we'll save the country.
I think what's interesting about this documentary is that Reich manages to put Republicans, both them and Democrats, around tables and get them to agree with him, actually, on this issue. And do you think Reich has all that political authority to do that?
Well, I mean, he is Democrat, he's very kind of entrenched in that world. But I like the fact that he's looking beyond that. He's looking at the point that this is about an establishment, anti-establishment thing. He talks about Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump being anti-establishment. They're opposite ends of the political spectrum. But basically what they were proclaiming or what they were trying to do was the same thing, just overthrow the system. And,
but
and that's quite interesting. It's quite interesting that he's brought them both into the story.
Indeed, and I think at the time, we see Trump there. It was early elections when they were, yeah. filming this documentary, and it was the front runners were Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton. But I don't think they could have foreseen that Trump would have won.
Well, no, nobody foresaw that, did they?
No, not at all. But I think the argument made in the film, though, is perhaps this anti-establishment sort of notion is that Trump was bringing corporate power to influence political power, which, of course, this documentary highlights. Would you agree with that, Clive?
Undoubtedly, and we've seen what's happened since. Trump has populated his administration with Goldman Sachs alumni and the usual suspects. So the system is so, corporate influence is so embedded in the system. And Reich talks about lobbying, but lobbying is just the sort of the visible tip of the iceberg. It's basically embedded in the whole superstructure.
Well, the tax law that they passed was just purely aimed at helping corporations.
Exactly. So, you know, the civil, what we call the civil servants in this country, the administrative engine is fully embedded with corporate interests. And the idea that changing the figurehead from red to blue or Democrat to Republican or vice versa is going to change anything. We saw it with Obama. We've seen it with Trump. You know, and you know, should this be a platform for another Bernie Sanders, it'll be exactly the same story. One has to question the system rather than the political flavor. And I think, frankly, I found that conversation with the Republican senator somewhat naive, really.
Oh, so Rich, what do you think about actually the arguments made in this documentary about the relationship between political power and the economy and corporate interests? Does it make strong arguments bringing the two together?
Well, it does. I mean, it makes very strong arguments that the people who have the money have the power. It's kind of obvious. But it's quite creepy to watch a film like this where they explain how that plays out through the lobbying, through the passage of laws, through financial contributions to campaigns, and then getting, you know, favors on the back end of that. And you realize that the system is just, it's just kind of eating itself, and it's very much it's perpetuating that corporate power and that kind of inequality to where the, you know, the middle class is just shrinking and shrinking and shrinking.
So perhaps not surprising, but very
telling. It's not surprising, but it kind of helps it helps you understand what's happening, because everybody knows this is happening, but nobody really gets why or how, or you know, how it's affecting them. And this kind of helps. It helps you understand it a little bit better, and perhaps helps you, gives you a voice. I mean, that's what this kind of a film does. It might get people to stand up and say, "Wait a minute, something has
to happen." It's an empowering documentary.
Yeah.
And there's
a moment in the film where they mention that this happened 100 years ago, which is really interesting. The exact same thing, and there was a huge backlash. The public came out protest. They elected all new people. They passed all these laws, which have pretty much all been overturned now. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. It's interesting that, you know, we're kind of repeating history. Mm-hmm. So
I would like to touch on that actually a bit more in the next section.
I've been working at McDonald's for 4 years. I work at the drive-thru window. I get paid $12.55 per hour. I make about $1,200 a month. $900 goes straight to rent, and I have to pay for gas, and then my phone bill, I end up with nothing. I sometimes have to go to the payday loan and get a loan on my paycheck in order to make it on time and don't get any late fees and try to make ends meet.
Nobody should be working full-time and not making it. Nobody in our society, the richest country, the richest nation in the history of the world, should feel as frightened and anxious and as insecure as so many people do today.
That was a truly heartbreaking scene to watch there. And Rich, what did you make of these sort of contributions to the documentary, these stories of McDonald's worker and also sort of farmer in the documentary also?
I think it's just an example of the thing that a lot of people are feeling, and it's regardless of what your political views are, that feeling like, why is life getting worse? Why is my paycheck not going as far as it went 5 years ago? Why do I feel like I'm earning less money and everything costs a lot more? There's something wrong here. When the wealthy people are just getting richer and richer and richer and richer, and they're buying cars and houses and they're living and they're talking about how booming the economy is, and I'm not feeling that. And those stories reflect that, reflect something that almost all of us feel, unless we're in that top 1%, I think.
And Clive, I want to ask that question that Robert Wright raises. Why is it that people who are working full-time are struggling to make ends meet in one of the richest countries in the world?
there's an inevitability in where we've got to. I referred earlier that the post-war consensus did actually give people some semblance of a decent life. They were working hard, but they were being well rewarded. They didn't have to have multiple jobs. But I think that respite was only temporary, and there's a much deeper underlying problem than what the documentary brings out. But what the documentary, the power of the documentary, is that it begins people on a journey of understanding. It may not go the whole way, but it certainly introduces concepts that may be totally alien to them, and having these stories actually puts them into the context of their own lives. But there is an inevitability to this idea that things get worse and worse, because essentially the wealth is sucked to the top, and there are very simple mechanisms that drive that. And it's to do with theft of what should belong to everyone, land, resources, etc., and usury, because it's just a straight interest on money. It's just a straight wealth transfer mechanism.
She said she had to take payday loans.
Exactly.
And of course,
so that
never
just exacerbates
debt.
It. Mm. So this process, inevitably, in days gone by, we had debt jubilees. And basically everything would be forgiven, we'd start afresh, and the system would reset. 1929 was a reset, and that's why all those laws were so effective, because it reset the economy. We had a crash in 87, we had a crash in 98, we had a crash in 2000, we had one in 2008. We've not had a reset. All that's happened is that the Fed has continued to pile more money into the system, which has done nothing to alleviate the hardship of people like that lady at McDonald's. But it's gone into asset price. It's driving more of the wealth to the top. So the system needs a reset. And the fear is that the reset will be much too painful. It'll be like the 1930s depression. And if we want to avoid that, we have to think in a different way. That doesn't come out of the film, but if this starts people on a journey of understanding.
At least it's a good starting point,
yeah. Yeah, I think it does a very good job of opening the door to concepts that people probably don't think about, although they feel them, as Rich says, on a daily basis in their own lives.
And Rich, before we move on, I just quickly wanted to touch on the point you made about Wright earlier on, about him. You can tell, you get a sense from the documentary, he's trying really hard, he's been a senior political figure in America, but it doesn't seem like he's getting anywhere, and you can see his spirits sort of go down throughout the years.
But it's just you know, watching the system get worse and worse, and he talks about seeing the seeds of what we're seeing now, seeing it back in the 80s, you know, and realizing that this was going to happen. It was just going to get worse and worse. And
you can feel the sense of frustration from him.
Yeah,
also.
You do see him getting frustrated. And you saw him, like, in the clips from when he was working with Clinton, and he's trying to change things. And, of course, he can't, because every bill he proposes is heavily compromised by exceptions and things, and which just basically made the situation even worse. Mm-hmm. So you do watch him kind of getting more and more demoralized, and then this film is basically his journey around the country to try to make sense of that and work a way forward. It is, like you say, it's an opening of the door to the theme. It doesn't really get that deep into it, mm-hmm. but it helps you understand in a way that you kind of makes you think, and you think, oh, maybe I do need to pay attention to the candidates more when the next election comes around, and pay attention to what they're saying.
Even in the insurance provider that I have, I was informed that they no longer cover chemo drugs fully. And so we were told by a medical social worker that we could potentially receive a bill for thousands of dollars. With the four drugs that I take for chemotherapy, the total comes out to about $3,000 a month per treatment. So for me, that's about 3 months of income just for one round of treatment.
What is the alternative to receiving your chemotherapy drugs? There isn't one. So whatever the cost is, you have to pay it.
You and I and everybody else in this country pays more for pharmaceuticals than any citizens of any advanced nation.
You would think medicine should save people, not bankrupt them. Rich, what impression did you get of the pharmaceutical industry from this documentary?
Personally, you know, I live in the UK, and our government right now is trying to create that system here, which is terrifying to me. That's terrifying.
Increasing privatization.
Yeah, and making it so that we have to pay for everything, even though we already pay for it. I find that really disturbing. But, I mean, this clip is part of a bigger point in the film, because he talks about how Americans pay more for airfares, they pay more for, you know, virtually everything. Internet access, mobile phones, everything is more expensive because of these special interests that have created laws that basically give them bigger profits. And that these companies are regulated outside of America because they're considered public utilities and they're not allowed to have obscene profits. Because they're utilities, they're something everybody has to have. And
of course, essential.
And that's kind of the, it's a bigger point in the film, is that these essential services shouldn't be allowed to make, you know, obscene profits and put people, you know, make people poor.
Would you agree with what Rich said? Your thoughts on the sort of free-for-all economy?
On the pharmaceutical industry specifically, I think there's a deep misunderstanding of how we got here. One of the original Rockefellers was a snake oil salesman, and he basically, through endowing universities, medical schools, and health facilities, basically alienated the whole idea of natural medicine. That lady said there's no alternative. There are alternatives, actually effective alternatives. And the pharmaceutical industry is not about curing people, it's about making money. And if people get better, that's a side benefit. It's certainly not the main thrust. So the cost is part of this, but it's actually the industry itself is perpetuating illness because it's profitable. And if you look at the insured model, and Rich mentioned what's happening in this country, you go back pre the start of this privatization regime, management costs in the UK were about 4%. In America, they're 20% with this insured model. We're now at the last, there was a secret study done. It's not been published. It's been available through leaks in various places. I think we're up to about 14%. But where we're heading to is 20% of the cost going into management. In other words, going back up.
That is very
top.
Worrying indeed. And just as we end near the end of the show, I'd just like to discuss one of the key messages of this documentary, which is the power of ordinary citizens, I suppose, to rise up and to challenge the 1%. Rich, do you think that this documentary ends on a hopeful note?
I mean, so many of these documentaries that make you angry end up by saying, you know, vote, use your vote, get out and protest. And, you know, that message has been going on for, we're 10 years into this economic system, this new world that we're living in, and it's not getting any better, it's getting worse. So
just your final thoughts on the film now.
Yeah, so I think the film helps raise issues that need to be raised, and we need to watch these kinds of films so that we understand what's going on, and maybe that will help us use our vote more wisely and get out and protest where it's effective. But it does kind of make you feel a little hopeless.
Well, I'm afraid we'll have to end it on a sad note there, but I wish we could talk more, but we've run out of time. Thank you very much. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you again to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambiati.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام من شقاء العيش ضيق المنزل
إمام الباقر عليه السلام stated a misfortunate way of life entails living in a cramped house.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find in the interesting, beautiful, profound, and deeply moving and inspiring conversations and dialogues of Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam, peace be upon him, this beautiful, wise, divinely appointed Imam from the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, we find that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam speaks about these beautiful pearls of wisdom and knowledge, these pieces of golden advice, which truly can move an individual and a society towards perfection. And of course, this perfection is the goal of Allah for humanity. So Imam al-Baqir, in this conversation with one of his companions, he speaks about leave that which does not concern you. And so, of course, this companion would have asked, well, what do you mean by leave that which does not concern you? And so here we find that leave that which does not concern you, interestingly, it means to kind of mind your own business, in the sense of when you don't need to be worried about something, then you don't need to worry about it. Right? Some people, they are just, their mission in life is to interject and intervene and just be in the middle of everybody's business, right? Well, dear friends, some people, they have this thing called a personal space. Perhaps not everybody is satisfied with you or me interfering in their business. Now, of course, when it comes to parents, parents should be in the business of their children. And of course, when it comes to amal bil ma'ruf and nahi anil munkar, right, when it comes to promoting the good and preventing the evil, this is another thing which must be done, and it is not included in this framework of mind your own business. Rather, one should promote the good, one should prevent the evil, of course, with the conditions and requirements which have been stated for amal bil ma'ruf and nahi anil munkar. But overall, you know, leave that which does not concern you. I assure you that if you follow this this word of wisdom, this statement of this divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, you will find that your life is much more peaceful, tranquil, and serene. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Although among true scholars there is not an issue of age, but of course this shows that if the difference of age is very great, and if those who are known to be great scholars in the community still go and sit, you know, seeking knowledge from someone who is much younger than them, and that shows quite a lot about the teacher himself. Otherwise, in the history of our ulama, you will see that, you know, there is no limit as far as seeking knowledge is concerned. Look at the example of Allama Hilli and Muhaqqiq Tusi. They were contemporaries. Muhaqqiq Tusi was more expert in what is known as the rational sciences of Islam. Falsafa, theology, you know, astronomy. And Allama Hilli was more expert when it came to proper Islamic sciences. And when they met and they knew one another, you know, they spent certain, you know, some time, he teaching him the rational sciences and the other teaching him the religious sciences. Both of them were, you know, at their own levels. And so this process of knowledge doesn't stop and shouldn't stop when the Prophet says, go and seek knowledge, min al-mahad ila al-lahad. He doesn't even put the restriction about the source of knowledge. He says, al-hikmatu dhallatu al-mu'min. Wisdom is the lost property of a believer. Khudhuhu. Go and seek that. Take it. It belongs to you as a believer. Walau min famil mushrik. Even if it is in the mouth of a mushrik. But you should be at least on the level where you can distinguish wisdom from garbage. That is the condition. But once you see that, even if it comes from a non-Muslim source, no, there's no problem. You know, so this is one example of the seerah that we have to learn, that even scholars of the time who were much older than the imam felt the need to go and seek knowledge from Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salatu wassalam.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
An IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com
www.ibenglishradio.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.